Writers' Voices once again with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Mark Stevens. Now, Mark is the son of two librarians raised in Lincoln, Massachusetts, and has worked as a reporter, as a national television news producer, and in public relations. His novel, The Fireballer, was named Best Baseball Novel by Twin Ball Literary Magazine and a Best Baseball Book of the Year by Spitball Magazine. That was back in 2023. And he has published quite a few other novels. And the one that we're here talking about today is Two Truths and a Lie, which is the second in the Flynn Martin series. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Mark.
Monica, thanks so much for having me.
So yeah. Tell me a little bit about how you went from journalist to thriller writer.
Sure, absolutely, glad to. So yeah, I grew up, as you mentioned, son of two librarians. At some point along the way, in middle school, I can tell you exactly, or junior high, they called it back in Massachusetts. I just knew I wanted to be a reporter. Reporter was going to be my thing. I loved reading the Boston Evening Globe. My mother would bring home. I watched Huntley Brinkley, the old NBC news. I just was fascinated by watching the world through news. I sat on the couch. I can see the couch. I can see the television. And I was on my high school newspaper. I was on my college newspaper. I got a job right out of college as a reporter. And on my third job in Colorado, somebody handed me a mystery. My first mystery novel. I'd been reading fiction for years, but somebody finally handed me a mystery. And it just opened up this whole world to me. And I started consuming mysteries at a very rapid pace, and soon decided, I thought, this is an interesting format because there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. I had only been reading kind of general character-based fiction to that point, where I really didn't feel like I could begin to capture a human being on the page. And the mystery format gave me some idea that I wondered to myself how hard it might be. So I started writing. It took me a long time to get published, and but I just kind of kept at it for 20 plus years until I got published. And knowing as I continued to write that crime fiction was I loved crime fiction. I just loved all the different varieties of it. So
Are all of your novels crime fiction?
Except for the baseball novel. That's The Fireballer is my only non-crime fiction novel. I have five mysteries out in a series about a female hunting guide in Colorado. She is, her name is Allison Coyle, and the series is called the Allison Coyle Mystery Series. And then came the baseball novel, and now is the thriller series, which book two, as you mentioned, is just coming out.
Right. Now, I found it interesting that your protagonist in both these series is female.
Yeah.
Tell me, why did you choose that? And how has it caused any, does it make it harder for you to write from that perspective?
Well, I'll answer the first part first. Okay. So the main character of the Allison Coyle Mystery Series was inspired by an actual woman I met in the Flat Tops on a day-long horseback ride. And I had only been writing kind of urban jungle mysteries to that point. The idea of an outdoor mystery series did not occur to me as some possibility, something I could write, until I met her. And I thought, wow, she runs against type. You expect to run into guys up in the woods. You expect to run into just men. And the idea that a woman is leading hunters, mostly male hunters, up in the woods just seemed so interesting to me. And the woman who inspired the character became a friend and somebody I could email questions to and do research with. I went on a trip with her. I went on a trip with another female hunting guide. I, just thought that this whole world would be an interesting world to explore in terms of setting up a stories for crime fiction. So those five novels, I guess, gave me confidence as I approached the thriller series. The thriller series came to me in a very quick fashion. I've talked about this before. It just sort of fell out of the sky, which I don't really believe in, but it happened. And I knew the antagonist in that situation had to be a male, a retired serial killer in the first book, No Lie Lasts Forever. And because the
that's such an odd phrase, retired serial killer.
Yeah. That's what I thought when the idea came to me too. I thought, wow, that's really an interesting idea. Well, because he is male, I knew that the protagonist had to be female, just for balance and for just a contrast. And so in the first book, a lot of the book is told from the antagonist's point of view. We're inside his head. It goes back and forth, back and forth. And that set up the kind of just the rhythm of that book. But you know, when I started with the Allison Coyles and with, you know, just approaching any female character, you know, I think it's my job to get any human being right on the page. Sure, it's daunting to write across gender. There's no question. And if you're featuring the opposite gender, you've got to do your homework. And there are certain things I won't write about. I'll leave it at that, you know. But I've read and purposely read a lot of female authors writing crime fiction and featuring female main characters. And I'd read carefully, trying to look for that one paragraph, that one insight, that one sentence, that one chapter, or something that just goes into some female perspective that is the special insight into all, you know, Venus versus Mars kind of reality about point of view around the world. And the more I read and the more you carefully look, you realize it's not so much about trying to capture the whole female perspective. It's trying to get your one character right, trying to understand your specific character and her background and her point of view and what she's trying to accomplish in the world and all that stuff that creates a character. So it's, I call it kind of an odd thing about my career, although I do love women. I respect women, I think. I just the way these particular stories have fallen out. And I would say The Fireballer is kind of, I guess, proof that I can write a male character, and I have some other books in the works that are male. And we all write about everybody. It's a matter of who you're featuring, you know. Right, it's a matter of who you're
giving precedence to. Yeah.
Right.
So I think in the past, particularly in crime fiction, the protagonist tended to be male partially because there was this idea that women would read books featuring men, but men would not read books featuring women. And therefore, if you want to capture the broadest market, you had to have a male. But there seemed to be a lot of series, a lot of female protagonists, not just in written thrillers, but also on TV, you know, the series that are being done. So do you think that has changed? Are men as willing to watch or read something where, you know, with a strong female lead as they are with the male lead?
Boy, I think so. I hope so. Of course, I want everybody to read. I still think women are the dominant buyers and readers, consumers of books. And I think that's particularly true in crime fiction. But I don't really I really don't analyze the data myself. I just agree with that in general. But I think you've seen, because it used to be that only men were private eyes, only men were police, only men were in roles of authority or insurance investigators or whatever the protagonist's role might be to drive a crime fiction novel. Now you've got lots of female private eyes and female police and female investigators, female prosecutors, many, much more, you know, even in the legal community, just because, you know, thank goodness the professions have opened up to both genders over the decades. You see that get featured more and more in the books. But I certainly think I have my share of male and female readers both. And I think it is interesting when you think of cozy mysteries in particular, for some reason you really think that that's the female audience.
Yeah,
and that's, yeah. And that's kind of interesting. And the thrillers are more the macho tough guys want to read these, you know, bare knuckle fist fighting books with lots of, you know, daring do and scaling skyscrapers and shooting helicopters out of the sky or whatever that might be. But that, well, that just goes in.
I personally like the cozy mysteries, but I've always been drawn to the grittier crime fiction, even like the Scandinavian writers that you don't get any grittier than that, I don't think. So even like I read all the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo series long before anybody else, or not anybody, but long before it became so well known. And I don't know why, because I'm, you know, I'm a pretty nice, normal, middle, Midwestern woman, you know?
Yeah. No, it's fascinating what we challenge ourselves to consume and dive into, and where we don't mind our heads going there as long as our physical body doesn't get in the middle of those situations.
Right. Yeah. Now, do you remember when you first started reading mysteries? Do you remember what writers you were reading?
Big time. Not only do I remember, I still go back to them. And the one that just is overriding all my thinking about crime fiction is Patricia Highsmith. And the ones I was reading earlier were Patricia Highsmith, James M. Cain, Elmore Leonard, and Ross McDonald. Those were my four kind of driving. I was a huge James M. Cain fan, and Elmore Leonard, the early Elmore Leonards. He's got such a huge variety of books, but
Wow. And you mentioned that you were writing for a long time before you got published. And those tended to be the kind of urban jungle type books. How many novels did you complete that did not
four,
get published?
Yeah, I had four finished novels before I got published. And then number three of those, although I had good New York agents for three of those four projects. I had John Grisham's agent represented me for number two. I thought in the early 1990s, because I had Grisham's agent, that I was set. My life, you know, in 1992, they were backing huge trucks of money back up to John Grisham's house every day and dumping it on his lawn. And I thought, you know, because I had Grisham's agent, I was a crime fiction writer, that I was on my way.
You had it made.
Yep. Yeah. And that book didn't sell. Book three didn't sell with another excellent agent I spent a year and a half with. Well, I thought they were excellent until after a year and a half, I got a very dry, cold, standard form letter rejection in the mail saying that our relationship was over. And so the fourth book I wrote was, not picked up by an agent. Interestingly enough, that was the book, the premise of that book and the early draft that ultimately became No Lie Lasts Forever, which came out last year in 2025. That book stayed in my drawer and I kept working on it for 20 plus years. But the third book ultimately got picked up by a small independent publisher outside of Boulder and started the five books in the Allison Coyle mystery series, which ultimately went to a medium-sized publisher called Midnight Inc. out of Minnesota. And that series ran for five books. So, I had I had lots of hope and lots of possibilities for getting close to getting my career going in the early 1990s, mid 1990s, but nothing came of it. But
wow. What kept you going? How did you stay motivated?
Yeah, I mean, I get asked that, and the answer is I just developed a habit. I developed a habit of getting up in the morning, and I loved that kind of process of creating something. And I guess the fact that I'd gotten close told me I was at least on the right track and to keep going on it, to keep going at it. I had just enough hope. It was definitely heavily shaken, not stirred, with a great deal of disappointment. But, you know, I just, that hope kept drawing me back, and I wanted to see what I could do. And by the time you start getting up every morning for 20 years or something, you just tend to, your brain starts thinking in those terms early in the morning, and you just get up and do it. And so I'm glad I did that. That what's really interesting to me is I'm so glad that those early agent relationships didn't lead to a deal, because those early books were not good. I wasn't there yet. Oh. I really, in retrospect, had I been published, Ed Grisham's agent sold that book, which I don't think will ever see the light of day, I think I would have been trashed. And I think I would have been more discouraged by having gotten published and reviewed, which I know would have been in very, you know, piles of negativity, that then I would have put it all down and given up. But they were right. The publishers at the time that those agents were trying to entice, those publishers and editors were correct. That it wasn't ready for prime time.
Now, you said the fourth one you did end up reworking, and it became a good book. Is there any possibility with any of the other three, or are they just not, there's just no there?
Well, the only one that won't see the light of day is number two. Okay. Number one, the very first book I worked on in the 1980s, is still one of my favorite stories. And I've been working on that, and my agent right now is looking for a home for it. And it may still, and it hasn't been that long that he's had it out there. It's a terrific premise in my mind. And because I know what I'm doing now, I think the execution matches the idea for the story. Number three became the first of the Allison Coyle series. And number four became No Lie Lasts Forever, 20 plus years later. So all three of the four are active projects. And the fourth is the complete dud.
You gotta have one of those, right?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure. For sure. Yeah.
That's how you learn. You learn more by failure than by success, I think.
Oh, I would endorse that 1,000%. Yeah. Like, yeah, completely.
So sounds like your writing routine, at least during those years, was getting up early, writing for how long?
I write for about an hour, hour and a half. Maybe a good day I'd go 2 hours, but a good 90 minutes, you know, somewhere in there. 600-700 words, maybe 1,000 on a good day. My main goal every day was just to make some progress, even if it was just some days just getting nowhere, but just coming up with one idea so the next day is easier. Just something to keep going. I don't, you know, beat myself up too much if I don't get 500 words down. But if I do, or get 500 or 700 words, I feel great. I just feel great. And yeah.
And then you'd go to your day job.
Right. And then I go to my day job. Yeah.
Okay.
And let it percolate. Let it percolate. Let it stay in the background of my mind all day, you know.
And then were there, like, during the weekends, would you write for longer times, or did you stick with that same schedule on the weekends?
Well, I love writing on the weekends when I don't have to shift over to the work mentality. But I still found myself just kind of doing that 90 minutes, couple hours. Maybe on the weekend, I would find another chunk of time in the afternoon, depending on what was happening with the schedule and family and things like that, where I might go in and do some more detailed, you know, rewriting or just go back and look at the big picture. But generally, all my, for some strange reason, all my raw new copy is that early morning time slot. It's just the way it goes.
So you still do that?
Yep.
And yep. Do you still have a day job or nope?
No, I'm 99% retired. But it's just my stupid brain. And it says, you know, now is the time to get up and do it. And, you know, it's quiet. There's no distractions. The dog, we have two dogs, but the one that follows me out now in the morning knows to just go lay down until it's really time to get going. And, you know, I like the darkness. I like the quiet. There's coffee? Just something about that time. Oh, yeah. Well, coffee for sure. No food. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. The coffee maker's ready to just punch on when I wake up. And yeah, by the time I'm really ready to sit down, it's got a cup waiting for me. So yeah.
Awesome. So you've published two of the Flynn Martin series with Thomas and Mercer. So you're with a large publisher, with a, you know, one of the big publishers now. And how many books do you expect to have in that series?
It will be just three. The standalone, well, what I thought was a standalone, No Light Lasts Forever, when it sold. And I proudly say, but the first editor who ever read that book bought it. After 20 some plus years of working on it, the first editor who read it bought it. She said, I'd like to take this and make it a tight trilogy. And I said, wait a minute, without being a spoiler, I said, the bad guy's in prison. You know, they are going to prison at the end of book one. She just said, make it work. I want to see the Flynn Martin character, and I want to see this whole dynamic continue. And I was really taken aback. I really had to stop and think about how that would work. But before No Lie got published, I went in and kind of cracked a few of the eggshell places where you can make a mess without destroying the book one, and just enough to set up book two. And I'm in the process of finishing book three now, which is due soon to come out next year.
So, you know, as I was reading Two Truths and a Lie, I had not read the first book, and there's quite a few sort of references to that past. Would you recommend for someone to go back to read the first one before the second one?
I think it would help a lot. And that was one of the challenges of in the Alison Coyle mystery series. There's a lot of changes in relationships over the five books, but you can pretty much dive into any one and sort of pick up those relationship changes. This one, there's a fair amount of intricacy to the past that drives what's happening in book two. And there's also, you know, several new threads to pick up. And one big one in particular involving a church and its businesses that she gets onto. But I'm the same way. If I'm reading a series, I really like to start at the beginning and pick up where the writer started too.
Yeah. I feel like I pretty much get the backstory, but there's some aspects of it that I'm just not very clear on. And, you know, what really happened between the, you know, Flynn and the villain, because you don't go into a lot of detail about that in book two. Like I said, I feel like a reader coming into that gets enough to know that there's something there, but it would be helpful to have more to have read book one first, for sure.
Yeah, I think generally happens if people do come across two truths, they might look at it and say, oh, better start No Lie first before I dig into this. And I think that would be helpful. Yeah.
Okay. So we have no lie. We have two truths and a lie. So is the third book, are there two lies in the third book? Went from zero to one.
No, I have a working title for book three, but it actually doesn't include the word. Well, yeah, I don't think I can share it yet. It hasn't been approved.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, Mark, why don't you read us a little bit from Two Truths and a Lie?
Sure. Glad to. Me start off with chapter one, and I think it does create a little bit of a bridge to the story. Chapter one, Two Truths and a Lie. She should have known better. When she thought about it later, she realized she'd let herself get lulled into complacency, into routine or by routine, take your pick, into thinking he had changed. For 4 weeks of trial, Harry Kugel walked the 10 steps from the side door to the defense table with his head slumped forward. For 4 weeks of trial, he sat upright. He might whisper in his lawyer's ear. He might put his hand to his mouth and issue a soft cough, but he was a poised model of courtroom behavior. For 4 weeks of trial, Flynn Martin sat in the front row pew directly behind Harry Kugel. She didn't need to reserve it. Her fellow reporters understood. On day one, when Harry first walked those steps from side door to defense table, Flynn was surprised at his clueless bearing. He stared straight ahead from his chair at his counsel's table, where he would sit for hours. He didn't look around. He didn't hang his head. He could have been a businessman striding to a table to close a deal. One last check of the numbers before the handshakes and champagne. Harry Kugel's attire took full advantage of his right to appear to the jury as an innocent state bureaucrat mistakenly identified as PDQ, the serial killer. Who, me? He walked into the courtroom as if the side door were a special portal to his mansion of carefree privilege, never mind the pair of beefy Denver cops who stared at Harry as the trial proceeded at its methodical pace toward its inevitable conclusion. 13 months after the arrest, Harry Kugel had lost weight. He hadn't had much to lose from the get-go, but on his first trip through that side door, he looked smaller than she remembered, gaunt. He wore the same black suit every day, but the shirts switched from gray to blue, and the ties rotated among four. Flynn kept a running tab for amusement. Day one, black suit, gray shirt, yellow paisley tie. Day two, black suit, blue shirt, gray striped tie. Day three, black suit, gray shirt, solid maroon tie, and so on. Now, noting his apparel was silly, but during the trial, Flynn liked to keep busy. Her notes were jotted down with all the other swirling doodles and her lame attempts each day to play courtroom sketch artist and generate a reasonable rendering of the ice-cool black judge or the slender and tall assistant DA who interrogated witnesses with an easy aplomb. The judge was no fool. Flynn kept a running tab of scratch marks under two headers. A scratch went under H, L, Harry lives, for each time the judge sided with the defense. A scratch went under H, D, Harry dies, for each time the judge agreed with the prosecution. Even though Colorado had outlawed the death penalty, a life sentence was the same thing to Flynn. Bye, bye. Harry's case, if the judge's daily decisions were any indication of a trend line, were circling the drain. Given her prominent position near the front of the room, Flynn vowed that her attention would never wane. Whenever she felt a tug of weariness, she'd focus on Harry Kugel's three victims and the brutal ways the three women had died. The effect was like mainlining four shots of espresso. The puzzle was Harry's weird demeanor in the face of so much evidence during his entrances. Harry's lawyer knew, all the reporters knew. The assistant DA's smooth delivery carried a touch more confidence with each passing day. Harry's parents, who had declined all interview requests from Flynn or any of the other reporters, knew it too. The jury, despite each of their personal claims that they had the ability to keep an open mind, watched evidence grow like an animated time-lapse movie of the plate tectonics showing how mountains are made. The big problem for Harry was everything Harry was carrying in his bag the night he was arrested. Syringe, fentanyl, mask, and all the theatrical tidbits that went with the instruments of murder. And there was the supply of fentanyl in his condo. and his DNA at Mary Belson's townhome and Mary Belson's spine-tingling testimony of how she'd fended off his attack. On and on. To her relief, the prosecution saw no need to call Flynn Martin to the stand. There was plenty of evidence to show that Harry Kugel had been in regular contact with Flynn Martin for weeks leading up to his arrest, and that he had invaded her home in an over-the-top attempt to prove his credibility. But the prosecution focused its case squarely on PDQ's long unsolved trio of murders, the detailed patterns of the scenes he'd left behind, and the direct link to his attempt to kill Mary Belson. The defense, such as it was, attempted to discredit expert witnesses and raise questions about how evidence had been obtained or processed. The defense team was left spinning in place, bald tires looking for traction in mud.
And that was Mark Stevens reading from Two Truths and a Lie. So when Flynn is a journalist, as it's obvious here, and there's a lot of detail in the book about how she works. And she's a TV journalist. So it was not a surprise to me when I read your bio and saw that you'd not only worked as a reporter, but as a national television news producer, because there's so much detail about that, kind of how the story gets on the air, that I never even really thought about. Like, talk about the B-roll and what that means.
Well, B-roll is a term. B-roll is a term for just kind of the background images. If you go to a scene or a setting, you might have the interview with your various people you're interviewing, and you might even be following them along as they do their job. That would all be the A-roll, the main stuff you need. But if you're in a new town, you might, what we used to say is spray the town. You'd take pictures of the train going by the town. You take a picture of people walking down the sidewalk. You take a picture of a sign leading into town. You take a picture of a cow in the farm or out in the pasture or something like that. That would all be B-roll, just images you can use when you get into the editing room to stitch your story together. And anytime you're watching a news piece, there's the main focus of your story, the thing that you're there to interview or person you're there to feature, and then it's all the sort of background images that are the B-roll.
I'm thinking it must be a really unique talent to know what will be interesting to viewers in that, you know, to make it a cohesive, coherent story.
Yeah, and I guess in some ways it's no different in actually writing the novel, because you're occasionally, you know, dropping in little side glimpses or side images of things that are going on in the background. If you're writing a scene, hopefully they're relevant and interesting and they're told in an interesting way. But sometimes those things can kind of be used for beats, you know, just to pace out your scene a little bit. And it would be no different in a television news piece. If you watch the good documentaries, there's always sort of the scene setting, mood setting, images that draw you in and begin to establish the whether the producer of the television spot has a certain approach, whether it's a dark approach to a story or something whimsical or bright. It sort of sets up your vocabulary in a way for what story you're trying to tell.
Now, how much input or how much pull does the reporter have as to what story they're going to tell versus the producers?
Well, I think that depends a little bit on the station and the expertise, the seniority of the reporter. Every network television operation, you know, like your big CBS, ABC, NBC, Fox affiliates, if there's a big station in a major metro city, you're going to have layers of editors who are going to look at a piece before it airs most of the time. And there's input from above, so to speak, to make sure it's checked, just like a newspaper reporter can't get a story through onto the newspaper front page until it's gone through a city editor and possibly another editor. The controversial story might go to the managing editor or the editor before it all gets published. So it's a team process, but in a smaller town and a smaller situation, that given how much the media has shrunk these days, it might be only one other person who might weigh in. And in some cases, there's probably zero. And in a live situation or in a live story where only minutes have gone by and you're watching news unfold as it happens on live TV, there's no check. It's being, there's the always the big risk of narrating history as it happens, right as it's going.
Yeah. So in Two Truths and a Lie, Flynn has a tendency to go rogue. Do you think that happens a lot in real life?
It happens. It does happen. She is a veteran. She's independent minded. I would say it's probably a little bit of license in the fiction to be able to let her go rogue. I think we readers of crime fiction like to see our protagonists tell their bosses that they know better. And, you know, whether it's a cop telling his superior police officer that he knows better how to investigate something, we always like to see our folks go off on their own and see if they can do a better job than the team mentality. So, yeah.
Well, one thing that I appreciated in this book is that while she starts out sort of like not being willing to bring the police in, keeping things to herself, and for a good reason, but it quickly becomes apparent that that's a road to disaster for her. And a lot of times in books, the lead character will continue to do that. And it's like, come on, aren't you ever going to learn? And she actually does learn. And I appreciate that she can't do it all herself, that she does need to pull some other people into this.
Yeah, yeah. She actually, she does have a little quasi team around her between her camera woman, her new boyfriend in book two, her father, and
her ex.
You know, her ex. And so she's got all males, and she understands that. It's kind of a little chorus, a little Greek chorus that she,
well, her camera,
you know, relies
woman
on.
Her camera woman, oh,
right,
is not
right,
male.
Right. Of course. And Tamika plays a big role, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the issues that, you know, you actually bring up a number of social and relevant and controversial issues in this book. When you set out, and we'll talk a little bit about each of them, but I'm just wondering, when you start writing a book, is that part of your intention?
Well, I'm trying to capture now, I guess, with this one, with the sort of just all the issues around the media being, you know, just attacked and declining, the media's trustworthiness, just how it's being ridiculed from powerful figures and the effect that that's having, the power of the internet and how much that has degraded newsprint, television stations, the idea that there's now a very widespread feeling that anybody can be a journalist and report any story. And in fact, that's really what happens. And we look at Minneapolis in the last few months and how many people, thank God, were recording certain stories. And we got to see within, you know, minutes, hours, days, so many different perspectives on incredibly dramatic, violent situations. I'd point out a few different things. One is, you know, just how kind of numbed we are to instantly seeing incredible levels of violence on our home screens minutes after they happen clear across the country, how used we are to ignoring the warnings that what you're about to see may be,
upsetting,
challenging for young viewers, upsetting. And yeah. We just keep our eyes open and keep watching anyway, because we are so used to this, which wasn't always the case. But secondly, just the incredible process that happens when you have multiple data points of people watching one scene and it's all being recorded, and there's still a process of evaluating what happened. There's still the need for an investigation, which is what good journalism is a process of taking multiple data points, not just taking one person who calls you up on the phone or drops you an email and tells you something is happening. You don't just take that as truth. You go through a process of checking. You go through a process of weighing and evaluating and digging and researching before you put something on air. And that might be a 2 or 3 hour process in some case. It might be a 6 month or 8 month investigative process in other cases before you publish a story. But that's what good journalistic institutions are set up to do. And it is a process to get to the truth, at least the first version of truth. And then ultimately history decides what is true.
So there is a plus to citizen journalism and the fact that we all are carrying around these incredibly powerful video cameras in our pockets every day. But it's only the start of getting to the truth, like you say. And I get so frustrated with people who are unwilling to believe anything on traditional media and will believe everything they see on social media.
Right, right. That is a scary prospect.
And they're like, well, they're biased. Well, everybody's biased. And there is no, at least in traditional journalism, you're getting some, well, actually I can't even say this because look at Fox, but you're getting some check, some variation of viewpoint that's not just a single one, but Do you want to comment on the Washington Post?
Yeah. Oh boy. Well, I mean, that's just a great example to me of comparing the Post to the New York Times. There's just so much there to unpack. But
Post used the New York Times, great. Right?
Yeah.
It used to be better, I think, than the Times in terms of of getting a balanced perspective. And Now it's sold out.
There's some excellent stories that have gone through Jeff Bezos and his decision about how to approach that. Clearly, if he decided to compete with the Times on a real journalistic level, it would cost him about 5 minutes of his income on any given day to devote to that cause, because it's such a small amount to prop up the Washington Post in a robust way compared to what he's all the wealth he's dealing with. So it's clearly a conscious decision to cave to an administration. It's a very short-sighted and horrible, horrible example of giving up.
Yeah. So one of the issues that you bring up in Two Truths and a Lie is the idea of what crimes actually get attention and get covered. And that, every now and then you hear, well, like if this were, when some young, pretty white woman goes missing and all the national attention, and you hear, yeah, but what about all the people of color who go missing every week, every day, and we don't hear anything about it? How do we change that?
Yeah, I wish I knew the answer to that, but it is it's just unbelievable to me how much resources go into certain cases You know, we had one recently with the mother of Savannah Guthrie in Arizona, with breaking into the daily routine of news to say, here's a little update. And the first few days after she disappeared, you had hundreds and hundreds of media sent to this one corner of Arizona because she's the mother and had been on air, somebody who was seen on air as a quasi, I guess, celebrity. And I understand that. And I don't disparage necessarily covering that. The question that you mentioned, I think, is more important, is how do organizations, news organizations, really value each human life the same? Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting to me with all the true crime podcasts and everything where they're going back and looking at cases of people who disappear and cold cases. One excellent thing about the citizen journalism or just the proliferation of podcasters who are digging up cases and asking questions about them, it's good because in some cases there were disappearances or murders that were kind of smoothed over and just sort of neglected, as they thought they had some reasonable explanation for a disappearance or a murder, and now everything is being reevaluated because of that initiative. Well, how do we notify the community in the moment that somebody's life was lost, or somebody has been missing for a few days or a few weeks, and draw attention to that? How do we value somebody whose status in life may be kind of under the radar and give them as much attention and care as we do
the mom? We actually are in the middle of a similar disappearance right here in our little town here in Iowa. A 75-year-old woman went to get her mail 2 weeks ago from when I'm recording this. And she lived in a neighborhood out in the country. So it was kind of a development out in the country, and just disappeared. And the police have been really good about, and you know, people have been searching for her, and they brought in bloodhounds and they had heat seeking drones, and there's just, she's just, nobody knows what happened to her.
But not a national story, just a local story.
And I'm hoping by the time this airs that the mystery will be solved, but it's really, it's just how can this happen?
And we continue to scratch our heads over Savannah Guthrie's mom. You know, it's a bit mind-blowing given all the cameras that are existing and all the technology that this could still happen, and you just have to wonder about motivation, everything. What's up
now in Two Truths and a Lie, Glenn uses neighborhood door cameras to find something successfully. And that's kind of a controversial thing now too, particularly with the Super Bowl commercial for Ring.
Absolutely.
Do we really want that level of surveillance? It's like, are we really aware of how much we are showing up on video surveillance?
No, it's incredible. I watched the I know in downtown London, if you are moving around as a tourist throughout the day, I mean, you're getting so many images of yourself on police security cameras, just because it's an intense area right in London. But it was, my wife and I were watching the Shetland series up in the islands, way up above England, and even the police there are using CCTV and constantly, and this is a very rural pastoral setting, and CCTV is everywhere up there. If the show is to be believed, I mean, it's interesting how they can occasionally, just for plot purposes, they'll say, well, we've got this on CCTV, but the next scene they'll say, well, that was a little too blurry, or there wasn't a camera in that area or something. But we have really set ourselves up a nation of security cameras, that's for sure.
Yeah, you would think that nobody could get away with anything anymore with all those security cameras. And yet crime still happens. One of the other kind of issues that is part of the plot of Two Truths and a Lie has to do with mega churches and religion going down the wrong road, I guess. And this is kind of, in a way, controversial to make a church the bad guy. Have you gotten any pushback on that?
Not yet. I might. I might also get a lot of people who say, thank goodness for raising this issue. And I'm certainly not the only one. Right. But, you know, you look at a church and their stated goals of helping those less privileged, those in need. The idea that, you know, you get all these tax breaks and you're supposed to be actually supporting and finding ways to help others. That's the bottom line, isn't it? Especially in Christian churches, aren't you supposed to be helping others and not finding ways to enrich the leaders, to have access to jets and vacations and, you know, business properties? There was actually a really good 60 Minutes piece a few years ago about the Church of Latter-day Saints in Utah and all their business dealings. And all their ways that they were under a nonprofit guise were buying business office buildings in cities. You know, what is all this about? Why do they deserve a tax break? Why, you know, they're sitting on massive amounts of property. I don't personally just in general dislike churches. I'm just saying, you know, where is the line here and right. Who's watching them?
Well, as an accountant, I will say I was very surprised that you got UBIT right, which is unrelated business income tax, or UBTI, unrelated business taxable income, which is a separate tax code for nonprofits that if they are generating income unrelated to their nonprofit purpose, that there is some tax on it, although it's a lower rate than general income tax. And just the fact that you even knew about that. So how did you know about that?
Well, the getting into that issue and putting it in Two Truths and a Lie, I knew it would get complicated. And I'm an old reporter. I spent years reporting, and what I would often do is make myself a list of questions and just go research. And I talk to people. I have an accountant who I could turn to and ask some questions. I actually sat down over coffee and went through some of that and just wanted to understand it. And I'd go back if I didn't. Same way with even just journalism. I was a television news producer a long time ago, but I needed to make sure I got all the today's television production.
I was going to ask about that. Have things changed? A lot?
They're changing every month, every year with television production because, you know, you used to be able to go live. Going live took, you know, a small van and a big antenna. You'd put up, you know, crank up the antenna from the van and try to find the right dish to bounce your signal off to get into your station. And now you can go live with your phone. You can use an app to go live with your phone if you've got a good signal. There are so many. The basics of going out and asking questions and gathering a story, that process really hasn't changed, but it's the technology around it. So when my agent picked up No Lie Lasts Forever after 15 or 16 years of it being in the background of my work, and he picked it up and liked it, he said, would you just go back and check and make sure all the technology is right? And so I contacted a former friend of mine who still works at a TV station in Denver, and she has become a resource for me to check just about anything. And I spend a day or so with her watching her work, and she's somebody I've been able to just reach out to, email or text and say, is this right? Is that right? And she's read both books before they got published and gone through them carefully. So
gave them the thumbs up. Another thing about
found a lot of mistakes.
Another thing about your about this book, and I assume all your writing, is the location is kind of really important too. You have a lot of detail about, you know, this is set in Colorado. You're in Colorado. Have you been to all the places, all the kind of scenes in the book?
The vast majority, yes. There actually is in Two Truths and a Lie, there's a couple of places in Kiowa, because we end up in way out in the exurbs, I guess, or almost farm country of Kiowa, out past Elizabeth. And so for the most part, yes, but there's a couple of places, and a couple are here or there are imaginary, but for the most part, the actual names of towns are all the actual places. Yeah. So, yes. I mean, I spent almost 40 years in the Denver area.
And there's a lot of detail just about what, about the setting, you know, that gives it a lot of color to the book. Yeah.
Well, I think the Colorado feedback and the Denver feedback has been great on that. And they say they've enjoyed, the people who know the area have enjoyed being able to read something that's really set in their backyard and with such detail. Yeah.
I bet. Okay. So one more book in the Flynn Martin series, and then what?
Well, my agent has two finished projects, which he's trying to find a home for right now. One is that very first crime novel I wrote way back when. And the other book is actually not a crime fiction. It's a novel set in the world of rock and roll. He likes it better than the baseball novel. My agent does. And frankly, there's some aspects of it that I like a little better too. So I'm very excited about that. And then I have a novel I'm working on as soon as I finish book three, which is due this spring. I had started a novel a few years ago about a small town reporter, an editor, having moved from Denver to a very small town in Southwest Colorado. I want to write about the media in a small town. And I've got a one-man band newspaper who's onto a very big story, and it's crime fiction. He doesn't really know where it's going, but it's going to get ugly. And as soon as he's got his whole story together, his owner is going to be shutting him down. It's actually... When you mentioned the Washington Post, it's sort of a small town version of that.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. Well, Mark Stevens, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. We always close with a quote, and I wanted to have a quote about journalism. And I think I'll go with one often attributed to George Orwell. Journalism is printing what someone else does not want printed or aired. Everything else is public relations.
Bingo.
All right. Well, thank you, and look forward to the next book, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.